You're listening to The Balance Point with Mark LaCour, the show that brings you real, raw energy dialogue. Warning, this is not your grandmother's podcast.
Hey folks, welcome back to another episode. I am so happy to have Bill Nussie here, partner at Engage and Tech Square Ventures, a free and energy author and podcast host. Welcome to the show, Bill.
I am really excited to be here. This is going to be a fun and I think eye-opening conversation. I'm looking to learn some things.
Yeah, and me too, looking to learn some things. So speaking of learning some stuff, a bachelor's electrical engineer from North Carolina State and then an MBA from Harvard Business School. What made you pursue those degrees?
You know, I was hold on. You know, it was an interesting time in life when I was younger. My father was ill and he had to retire and we didn't have a lot of money. So college came around and I applied and got into some good schools like MIT, but NCSU, North Carolina State, made it pretty easy because they gave me a full ride. And the reason I went to NC State was they had a phenomenal electrical engineering department. And at that point in my life, my dream was to be a Disney Imagineer. I wanted to build robots and NCSU had one of the best robotics programs in the country. I ended up not liking school. I did, got decent grades, but school was just not how I wanted to spend my life. So I swore I'd never go back. And then until, I was convinced by many people to get a MBA. And so again, a funny story, I reluctantly went out and surveyed the MBA landscape and found there was only one, business school in the United States that did not require the GMATs. And at the time, my father was had passed away, and we were selling. I was selling my company, and super busy time. So I just applied to Harvard, and I got in, and it changed my life.
Wow, what a great story! And you know, having to go through his hardships at an early age was rough, but being able to get that MBA from Harvard, that is really cool. I did not realize that they didn't require a GMAT to get in.
There was only 2 years, Mark, where they didn't require it. And I think the reason they started requiring it again is they looked at me and they said, what? We let this clown in? Put the GMATs back up.
Yeah, it's funny. So my degree is in wildlife management, which funnily enough, I've almost never used in my entire life until I actually got into the podcast business. And now it's an edge. So where did you go after school?
So after undergrad, well, while I was undergrad, I started my first serious company and grew it to be a global software company back in the days when that was fairly unique and sold it. And that money from the exit paid for me to go to business school. But after business school, I was planning on joining the ranks of startups again. That's what I love. Love building companies, passionately love it. And I started getting all these inbound offers to become a venture capitalist. And it turns out that at the time in history, there was very few people who had actually built companies and had MBAs from these fancy schools that venture capitalists like to hire from. So I ended up getting recruited into a firm called Greylock, and I was the 13th person they'd hired in their 30-year history. And
wow.
But notably, I was the first one that ever quit to get running companies again. So I've gone back and forth, and we can talk about it in a minute, but I'm back in venture capital. So a bit of a seesaw there.
Yeah, that venture capital world from the outside to me always seems strange. And this is once again me saying from the outside, but it's almost like they're so busy, they don't have time to do the real research. And it's almost like a mathematical game. Like I have $10 million, I put $1 million in 10 companies. Statistically, one's going to knock it out the park and cover everything else, and then one will be okay and the rest have failed. And I've always thought, man, if you could just back up and look at what were the key indicators of the companies that were successful, couldn't you replicate that and have a higher degree of good exits? And maybe I'm wrong, but from the outside, that's what VC money
you think
looks
so,
like
right?
To me. Yeah.
You're right. It's Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoonist, famously said that venture capital's is a really funny business because you only have to be right 1 in 10 times. He said it's a good job if you can get it. And the truth is that it's filled with lots of really smart people, thousands of smart people. And I assure you, they have done that math and much more. And to their surprise, that this is a bit of an artisan business and it defies it defies the traditional math and analysis that you would think would yield answers. It just doesn't. Over 30, 40 years of venture, It really does come down to sort of like creating a great movie or a great piece of music that is popular, right? It's somewhat, is it the right music? Is it really good? But is it the time in history and people want that kind of music? And is there a certain gift that's hard to put your hand around? But there's a certain gift to people that do venture capital particularly well. I'm not among them, but people that do it particularly well, it is as much a gift as someone who can swing a ball and hit a home run or someone who can, you know, sing across five octaves. It's a very rare gift to people that do it exceptionally well and one that defies math, I think.
Yeah, there has to be so much put into that. I never even thought about the point in time, but you and I both seen that a million times where a company that started too early, we actually had that with our ESG podcast. I saw ESG coming down the road. We started a podcast, but I started it too early before companies wanted to actually do anything about it, and it failed for 2 years, and now we're relaunching it because now's the time where people are actually, So, good insight. So, partner and engage. Age now. Let's talk about that a little bit.
You know, I was going to go build companies. That was my assumption. I finished this book, Freeing Energy. It gave me a great insight into the energy transition that's taking place across the world. And I found innumerable really cool startup opportunities, both existing companies and ones that needed to be built. And I was, having finished the book, I was going down the path to spinning some of those up. And once again, my inbox was full of people who thought I should join venture capital. And I thought that was an ironic happening again when I wasn't expecting it again. And at first, I really wasn't interested, but Engage was really unique. You know, we don't need to get into it a ton today, but the firm has, Engage has a completely unique model for venture. You can think of it like software as a service, which is now the predominant software model, but it replaced selling software as a license on diskettes and tapes a long time ago. And it really upended and expanded the entire market. Uber and Lyft replaced taxis. And so I do believe that there's a new model emerging, and I believe we are the forerunner of it. So the reason I joined, it wasn't because I wanted to become a venture capitalist, although that is actually a very fun job. Scott Dilbert is right. But it's also a chance to really build and scale a brand new business model that happens to be venture. And that's just as exciting, if not more so exciting for me. So there was really a couple of reasons I leapt back into it, having swore I would never do it again.
That's what you get for saying you'd never do it again.
Never say never if you're me.
It's funny. I went 7 years out of speeding ticket. And one day I said, you know, I've been 7 years out of speeding ticket. And I got one that day. You mentioned Free and Energy Project. Let's talk about that. How did it get started and where is it now?
You know, when I sold my company to IBM a couple of years ago, and IBM invited me to run strategy for them for the CEO and SVPs, which was an incredible honor. And I always knew in the back of my mind that I probably wasn't going to make my career at IBM. And I really had set out this goal, having a little bit of financial comfort and a good resume and a better network, that I should do something that really mattered in a larger context. And so I really had three boxes I was looking for. The first was to make the planet a better place for the future of my children and so on and so forth. The second was that there's 1 billion people today that have virtually no energy of any kind. And third, I'm a capitalist and I wanted to find something that was going to make a ton of money, mostly because I'm going to give it away. I've given away most of the money. The biggest bulk of the money I made from selling my company to IBM, we're in the process of giving it away. And hopefully if I make a lot more, I'll give all that away too. But it's still a wonderful scorecard that the work you're doing is mattering in some way. And you can double down by putting it towards things that matter even more. So energy, clean energy really caught my attention because if you do the math, it is pretty inarguably the largest business opportunity in the history of humanity. I like to tell people in venture that if you look at all the money we invested over the last 25 years as a global industry, in other words, all the money that went into Facebook and Tesla and all venture-backed companies, successful and none, it was a total of about $1 trillion over 25 years in total. If you look at the most conservative numbers for the next 25 years, investing in clean energy, it's typically the about $1 trillion a year. So 17, 18, $20 trillion over the next couple of decades. And those numbers were calculated before the United States and Europe started leaning more heavily policy-wise into clean energy. And McKinsey estimates, I'm sure you've this has come up a million times in your podcast, but McKinsey estimates that the transition is going to garner around $9 trillion a year of investment globally. Whether that number is $9 trillion or $1 trillion or half a trillion, the amount of money that's changing hands has no precedent in anything we've ever done in humanity and business. And that was something I wanted to be part of.
Yeah, I definitely see the appeal. I didn't realize the IBM. I did a little background check on you. Somehow I missed that. So thank you for letting IBM acquire your company, because IBM is one of our sponsors, one of our shows. Love those people over there, but they are a big old ship. I love them. I don't know if I could work there. But then I didn't realize that you had that connection back then. All right. So you wanted to get involved in something bigger, something to help the world, which I love that. We give back too. It's part of our core culture. And so literally, what is the Free Energy Project?
Well, I wanted to, as a business person, and particularly as an entrepreneur, I wanted to find a way to participate in this ginormous revolution that's taking place. And for the first, first year or two of researching and writing this book and starting my podcast, I kicked it off with a TED talk that I did. I was getting pretty concerned because on the electricity side of energy, as you know, and hopefully we can discuss a bit today, this, unlike the oil and gas side, electricity is really a monopoly. It's a government-granted monopoly. And since it was created as an industry by Samuel Insull, who I talk a lot about in my book back in the 1920s and 1930s, it's really remained this cloistered, uncompetitive, monopoly-protected industry. And so as an entrepreneur, I was like, holy cow, this is crummy. There's nothing to do here, right? You can't lift a finger without having state regulators change their minds on what they've been doing for 100 years. But in my moment of desperation, Mark, I stumbled into an idea that has really become the mission of my life, which is this whole notion of what I call local energy, which is these small scale systems, rooftop solar, solar on your church, your school, your house, your community center, your campus, your office park, batteries, electric vehicles, all these systems where the energy is now in the hands of individuals and small communities. And this changes everything because it becomes competitive. And when it becomes competitive and it works at a small scale, which is not the case with nuclear or coal, but a solar panel and batteries work wonderfully at small scale. All of a sudden, this same garage, the same innovation and revolution that took place in the garages of Silicon Valley and across the world that launched the internet and personal computers is now bringing that magic to the world of energy. So entrepreneurs by the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands can now actually participate in the electricity industry in ways that were just not economically realistic until 5 years ago. And that's got me excited. That's what my book's about. That's what the podcast is about, is how entrepreneurs and innovators can play a much bigger role than anybody thinks in the next generation of energy.
You know, Bill, you're 100% right. Actually, something popped in my head while you were talking through that. So I've always been a big proponent of solar and battery, especially for parts of the world that still burn cattle dung and wood for fuel, right? Because most of the world isn't spoiled by abundant energy like we are here in Europe. They would be happy to have a couple of kilowatts of, or not kilowatts, but a couple of watts of electricity to run a light bulb, recharge a cell phone, power a small refrigerator. But when you mentioned the Tesla component and you were talking about how it's basically a monopoly, and I'm guessing you're saying it's a monopoly because of the infrastructure and the rules and regulations around it, you are right in the fact that if I put solar in my house and you had solar in your house and we both had – if you had a Tesla and I had a F-150 Lightning, when the solar wasn't working, our battery-powered vehicles could then dump that money back into a small grid between your house and my house, and you and I together would actually have our own electrical system. But it had nothing to do with the utilities at all. I can see how you could take that idea and spread it out. And I may be totally off base what you're thinking about, but it just popped in. It's like, he's right. Things have changed so much that you could actually compete with utilities with what we have existing today.
Well, here's the problem, that the scenario you described is fundamentally and absolutely illegal in the United States. Everywhere.
Really?
Yeah, now in Japan, wide open. Australia, they're doing it every single day. Across Europe, there is legislation that makes what they call energy communities viable. And it basically says, listen, we care more about consumers and people saving money and creating resiliency in the face of this outages, whereas in the United States, the default still is, hey, if the utilities might be a little less profitable, we'll make sure all the laws support, make sure that doesn't happen. So it is illegal for you and I to trade electricity as next door neighbors and almost everywhere in the United States.
That is asinine. Now, is that a byproduct of old legislation, or is that something that's actively done to suppress this type of new way of processing or thinking?
Yes and yes. It's never been an issue for utilities up until five or six years ago, because the only people putting rooftop solar on their houses or churches or buildings 5 years ago were because they were environmentally motivated. And so that's one of the reasons this whole debate has become so partisan and so divisive, because it has become political. But the simple fact is, now in 2022 and getting better every year, if you put solar on your roof of any building that you own or you manage, the electricity it generates per kilowatt hour is far cheaper than buying it from the grid. And that gap is only going to get larger. Electricity from the grid in every state is going, virtually every state is going up. And the price of putting that rooftop solar up is going down every single year. You know, fun fact, if you put a standard solar set of panels on your roof in the United States residentially, the average works out across the country pretty consistently about $3 a watt. So you put a 4kW system up, it's $12,000, and it's pretty consistent across the United States. If you take that exact same hardware, the same solar panel, the same SKU, the same inverter, and you have people climbing the roof in Australia, the identical system costs $1.10 US.
Wow.
One third the cost. The difference is bureaucracy. The US is just a rat's nest, a maze of intermingling interconnection requirements and safety codes. And Australia said, listen, rooftop solar makes sense for our voters. Let's just make it uniform across the country. Bam. One third the cost. The US will get there. And that means that the price of rooftop solar is going to become so much less expensive than electricity from the grid, that it's going to become a massive disruption. And that's what my book, and that's what Freeing Energy is about.
All right. I'm going down a rabbit hole here because my mind has just been blown. And I want to understand better. So is the constraint, the legal constraint from the utilities, is it using their infrastructure? So literally, if you and I had a house next to each other and we built our own infrastructure, is that can't be illegal, can it be? Sharing electricity that way?
Technically, if we're also connected to the grid, it's dangerous for us to connect each other to.
No, of course.
And so, but if we were on our own, we weren't connected to the grid at all. It depends on which state you're in. In California, I think it's very difficult, ironically. But there are some examples. Everyone's talking about Babcock Ranch down in Florida, which I guess 60 Minutes just did a big piece on. And CBS News and others, they're all discovering. And this is 100% what my book is about. There are lots of stories in my book about similar ones. I didn't cover Babcock Ranch, but essentially this whole community right next to Fort Myers, a hurricane went right over it. They have 700,000 solar panels. And then most of the houses also have solar. And by the way, I mean, this is Florida. So this is not sort of a deep blue Democratic part of the country. Right. And by the way, not a single solar panel blew away in the hurricane, because guess what? If you build it to withstand hurricanes,
right.
you can. And the light stayed on the entire time. People were watching television and, oh, there's a hurricane coming. Oh, Fort Myers is getting destroyed 10 miles down the road, but we're perfectly fine watching, our beer's still cold and our refrigerator's, still working. And then once the hurricane blew over, people from all around Florida flocked to the Babcock Ranch, and the people that live there just opened their homes and their community centers for people who had no power and had no nothing. And so, and Babcock Ranch was also designed to withstand hurricanes. So all the houses remained intact. So this is the future. And that's why this is so exciting about this whole local energy idea, because like Babcock Ranch and dozens of other examples show us, it works, it's real, it's now, it's affordable, it's actually cheaper.
Yeah, I totally get it. So I live in Richmond, Texas, and not too far away from me, there was a guy that was upset that he couldn't get broadband, and he happened to be I think he was an electrical engineer, now that I think about it. So he went out, laid his own cable. He got his neighbors all chip in like $200. Actually, laid his own fiber, and he brought it to an AT&T connection, a DSLAM. And AT&T at that point was happy to give him a commercial connection, so he paid for it. And then he just divvied it up to his neighbors so they all had broadband. And then later, AT&T found out what he did, and they had made the economic decision not to put fiber in his neighborhood. This guy basically built his own fiber network. And so they took him to court, and AT&T won. And it bothered the bejeebies out of me because it's like, you know, here's a private individual with the help of his community did something to help everybody, and he didn't make a profit, although he covered his cost. And yet the regulations let big AT&T, and I hate to say that, shut him down after he did all this work. Are you telling me that the utilities are sort of in the same boat where they're worried about other ways of providing electricity to a community that they don't want to do themselves? Or is it the old government thing where they have jobs and they're worried about losing their jobs, and so they're going to make sure that they're the only game in town?
I think it's a little bit of both. And to be clear, I think the future electric grid needs utilities. And I have interviewed dozens and dozens of utility executives, and not a single one of them was this Mr. Burns character from The Simpsons, right, with a snivelingly trying to stick it to their customers. But they believe, as they have for 100 years, that the model they have, this protected monopoly, is not only advantageous to them and their shareholders, but they actually believe it's necessary, and they don't think there's another way to make electricity affordable, widely available. They're just wrong, but that is a deeply held belief. And so there are stories in my book, and easy to find, of electric utilities doing some pretty crummy things to prevent local energy systems from happening. You know, there's a story that's not in my book, it's more recent, but you remember last year when New Orleans lost all the power and they were out for 3 or 4 days, and a lot of consequences from that. And the story that people didn't realize was that a couple of years previously, New Orleans knew that this kind of thing could happen. And so they started down the path of putting solar and batteries on some of the more important facilities in the community, in the schools, the community centers, health centers, police, fire departments. And the utility basically came in and said, no, don't do any of that. In fact, disallow it. Instead, we're going to build a giant natural gas plant right outside the city so that it doesn't rely on the transmission wires to, you know, it just comes right into the city. And the decision was made by the New Orleans City Council. And they were really, you can imagine, they were leaning towards letting the community take care of it with solar and batteries. But what they changed their mind because apparently dozens or hundreds of people were protesting outside the city hall when they were making this decision. And these people were saying, you know, natural gas works. The utilities got the money. These small systems don't work. And they were protesting. So they were persuaded, and they basically went and paid $300-400 million to build a natural gas plant outside of New Orleans. And as you know, that natural gas plant totally failed. New Orleans went black. What isn't as widely known, but again, you can look it up. It's, you know, every major, there's no dispute on this. This isn't sort of partisan news. The utility was fined $5 million when it came out that all the people that had protested were paid actors.
Yeah, you know.
And that story happens in all over the country. Utilities are doing things we wish they wouldn't do, but they do. Some of them do. And so they're both upfront and sometimes in a less than a high character way trying to stop this local energy thing, because it does represent an existential threat to their business.
You know, one of the worst things / best things I think's ever happened to us is social media. Everything has been politicalized, right? Our weather's been politicized, energy has been. And so depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, you don't understand, you either don't listen or you don't understand science. And this goes on both sides, no matter what topic we're talking about. And it's really, really hard to find out facts about things. So 100% understand where you're going with this. I see it. I didn't realize utilities intentionally or unintentionally were in the way of this progress. I do want to ask you this thing. So storage has always been the high cost item, right? Whether you have wind or hydro or solar or whatever. And storage typically is chemical batteries, lithium ion batteries. Are the costs coming down? Because I've seen a lot of stuff lately about different ways of storage, mechanical storage where you lift heavy weights up, water storage where you lift when you have tons of electricity, you pump water up and then drop back down through a turbine. Where's the storage part in this, in these small communities that are powering themselves? How does that work? Is it storage for each individual house?
Doesn't matter. You can do it at the house. You can do it at the central. This is – It's kind of like saying, how's the internet going to work? Or are you going to have large central computers? You're going to have clouds. You're going to have individual smartphones. You can do any way you like when you change the model to this distributed architecture, which is where the world's going for energy, for electricity. But you know, I was just moments before you and I were on the phone today, I was reading about someone who said, you know, the problem with solar and solar is that it requires batteries in order to be dependable, and batteries are too expensive. And I just laugh when I see this. And I did a lot of research in the book, and it's all rock solid research. It's government data. You know, it's no environmentalist data. It's just stuff that really no one can argue with. And no one disputes it either. I mean, the fact is that lithium ion batteries, as an example, Mark, have dropped by 10 times in less than 10 years. And if you read the things that I do, they're going to probably drop another 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And so while today counterbalancing solar and wind in the intermittency from those power sources is difficult economically to do it at scale, just to make the whole power grid switch over to solar and wind. But in 5, 10 years, the economics of batteries will be so cheap that it's a layup. It's not even an issue. And it's like, you know, when I remember my business school professor saying that digital cameras were, you know, finally technically feasible, but there's no way that we're going to get rid of film because it's not possible for digital technology to ever have the fine grain resolution and the nuance that film does. And there's no way that in my book, I talk about one of my favorite Bill's a Dummy stories when I saw my first dial-up internet connection for the internet. And one of my colleagues asked me, well, do you think this could actually replace, like be a way to stream video? And I said, of course not. I mean, do you know how far the technology would have to go for you to actually get decent video over the internet? Come on. I mean, that's completely unrealistic. And anyone who says that batteries are too expensive or will be too expensive and that solar is going to be too expensive or you can't run the grid that way is basically betting that 100 years of technology progress and 3 or 4 decades of solar and battery technology progress are just stopping now.
You know, that's a great reminder to the audience because you're 100% right. I can tell you story after story. I got my start in the oil and gas industry working for the phone company East, Bell South. That was later acquired by AT&T. And I remember our mergers and acquisition companies looking at this startup called Netflix, and they end up deciding not to invest in it because the bandwidth was too expensive to stream video. And look who's still around. Netflix is not Bell South. That's so funny. What a great reminder. So we mentioned earlier, we talked a little bit about natural gas-fired power plants. So everything you just described, how does the oil and gas industry work in all this?
Well, I have two views on it, and I hope we have time to cover as much as you like. But one view is what that means to electric utilities. And this is something that nobody talks about and would be good for your audience and mine to hear because it's easily overlooked. And the other one, of course, is the clean energy and how that interplays in the coming decades with fossil fuel energies. But to the first one, Mark, I think everyone agrees that throughout the world that electricity is delivered via utilities, which are generally protected, regulated monopolies. And you know, these are companies that don't worry about their NPS score too much, and they really haven't had to reinvent themselves very often in the face of competition. You know,
right.
In my book, I cite out several government sources from like the Bureau of Labor Statistics and others that show that electric utilities invest less money in R&D than any industry in the planet Earth, less than used car dealerships. And so they just don't have they don't have a culture of innovation. And one of the points that I make in the book, which I wish people would talk about, is the oil and gas companies are coming. And, you know, it's a question of speed, but there's no doubt that, you know, for example, Shell has famously said they plan to be the largest electricity company in the world.
Yep.
And I haven't spoken to a single electric utility executive who's really got his or her head around that. So, a company like Shell or Exxon is literally 10 times larger than the largest electric utility in the United States, 10 times larger. Their asset base is way more than 10 times larger. But more importantly, their political power is then again even larger because they've been around so long and they have had to rely on government support for, you know, to determine how competition works and how it doesn't. They've needed militaries to support it. I mean, it's a crazy history. Thank goodness it worked because society wouldn't exist without fossil fuels. But the utilities have no idea what's coming. None.
Yeah, I never thought about that. You're right. It's literally if your ExxonMobil sets its sights on you, you're gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a garden gnome versus Godzilla.
Yes.
Right? And they're just sitting still. They don't even know how to move. And the oil and gas companies are doing a lot of smart things. They're investing in EV charging all over the place. It's an obvious bridge for them. But they're getting into electric energy everywhere. And their assets, the trillions of dollars of cash flow that they can put into owning the next state of energy, we're going to see an incredible push for hydrogen. I have some friends that try to convince me that hydrogen is uneconomic. And I said, it's uneconomic when compared to a solar cell, but it's incredibly economic if you're Shell or Exxon. And so the amount of R&D that these companies are going to spend, oil and gas companies are going to spend to come at the electric grid in every imaginable way. Hey, storage is kind of expensive today. But when Shell, Exxon, BP and others invest $250 billion to lower the price of hydrogen so that their pipelines and their distribution centers are still very relevant, guess what? Hydrogen is going to be cheap as all get out.
Yep.
We're not even going to worry about lithium-ion batteries when hydrogen comes into fray because the oil and gas companies have so much resources to put into it and so much win when hydrogen is successful. That's just one example. We can go through many others. I do think that oil and gas has a very large role to play. Maybe not the one that they think of themselves today as, but I do think they're going to be dominant players economically in the future of clean energy.
Yeah, if you think of any industry that can deliver large, complex, global, expensive projects on time and on budget, it's us. Bill, it's the hydrogen thing. I've always been bullish on hydrogen, but it just occurred to me what you meant by that. And correct me if I'm wrong. I didn't even think about using surplus solar or wind electricity to generate hydrogen, whether you electrolyze seed water or produce water or whatever, and that's your storage instead of the battery. Boom, absolutely. My mind just got blown. That's ridiculously easy to do.
And here's something funny that people don't think about. The hydrogen critics will tell you that, well, compressing and storing hydrogen is incredibly expensive and it reduces the economics 50, 60%. Well, guess what? The United States, because of oil and gas particularly, turns out that we store, by my measure, about 3 months of all gas used every year in giant underground caverns. The geologic expertise that oil and gas has isn't limited to extracting fossil fuels. It's also storing gas as part of the distribution system. And those, not all, but many of those underground storage reservoirs can be repurposed for hydrogen, and you don't have to compress it. So we already know how to store unimaginable volumes of gaseous energy. And so that's just one more reason that oil and gas is going to cross the Rubicon, so to speak, when it comes to hydrogen becoming mainstream.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a little bit of research. The compression and the of natural gas into liquefied natural gas is something that we figured out how to do economically so you can move it around. I don't see them being a big difference between hydrogen, but although I don't know the physics behind it. Is it? Yeah.
Oh, it's way, way harder to compress hydrogen and to freeze it. Just so CNG and LNG are both much more economic than hydrogen because the compression ratios, I believe, are substantially higher.
Okay.
Natural gas isn't nearly, propane is super easy, which is why we cart it around in our trunks for our barbecues. But natural gas is quite hard. Methane is quite hard. But we figured it out because it's so valuable that even after all the energy loss and the container requirements to store liquid or compressed natural gas, it still makes sense when you're shipping it overseas. But in the United States, we don't ship it around. We just ship it at standard pressure through pipelines.
Right.
Slightly elevated pressure, but we store it in slightly elevated pressure on the ground, but none of this expensive, crazy stuff like we do at the LNG terminals.
Yeah, and to your point, the infrastructure's there. It's been there for a long time. So there's another side of the oil and gas industry I think that you want to talk about a little bit as far as how this works in all of this. And that's the clean energy part.
Yeah, I think that this is an economics question for me. And politics and policy play, those are different things, but they play a very important role in determining the ultimate economics that hit businesses and consumers that decide ultimately whether we build another natural gas plant or we build another solar and battery plant. But in the long run, the thing that I think people forget about is that solar and batteries are technologies and not fuels. And this is the single largest takeaway from my book and my research in freeing energy broadly, is that, you know, fuels, whether it's oil or gas or coal or uranium, are driven by a centuries-old economic model and take great amounts of technology. Take fracking, for example, have dramatically shifted the economics of extracting oil and gas and have made the United States once again the hydrocarbon superpower of the world, which is pretty cool in some ways. But those are all marginal because in the end, it's still a fuel, and you have to dig it up, you have to move it, you have to create a system to burn it, and then you have to, in some cases, like of nuclear, you have to actually pay for its disposal. Other places, you just ship the, you know, like in a coal plant, you just stick the coal ash behind the coal plant for forever. But so there's no cost there. But the thing is, solar and batteries, by the way, not wind and not geothermal. Solar and batteries are technologies. And as a result, we make them in increasingly large quantities. And just like our iPhone getting cheaper, just like the internet getting cheaper, solar and batteries are going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Here's let me give you some numbers. I wish people look at these. You talk about numbers and facts, right? So most people agree if you make more of something, it's going to get cheaper, right?
Right.
So if you look at nuclear power plants, we've made 440 since the beginning of time, and they are actually going up in price for a lot of reasons. So we make so few of them, we don't have a chance to learn and rinse, repeat, and improve. We've made about, I should look the numbers up, but roughly about 2,000 coal plants. And that price is kind of going up, but it's more for environmental policy reasons. If we could do it the way we did in the 60s, they'd still be pretty cheap, like they are in China. Natural gas, we've made a lot of, because we took airplane turbine technology and we applied it to natural gas. And we now can ship a natural gas turbine in the back of a train, and we can make them in factories. And so we've made thousands and thousands and thousands of natural gas turbines, which is one of the two reasons natural gas has become so cost effective. And now, as a baseload, the cheapest way to generate electricity. But then wind, which has dropped precipitously 30, 40 times in the last couple of decades, we have built about 500,000 wind turbines across the earth.
Jeez.
So you can imagine, just think to yourself, like I've been to wind turbine factories, right? They make them in giant assembly lines. They ship them out on trains and you know, big trucks, and they assemble them on the spot. But they're basically making such a large number of them that every generation, every 10,000, they get a little smarter, they get a little cheaper, they get a little longer lasting. That's how technology works. But you're still talking 500,000 something. So a number that surprises people. But if you look at the number of solar cells that we've made since we started making them about 3 or 4 decades ago, we have made 120 billion solar cells, billion with a B. We have had more time to look at how to increase the efficiency of solar cells than anything we've ever made in history, except for some microchips. And by the way, it's the exact same, very similar technology. So we started making solar cells decades after we started perfecting microchips. We just took the microchip tech and applied it to solar cells. And now we've made 120 billion of them. And scientists will tell you that we know more about the way that electrons flow around in silicon than anything we know about anything in the world of physics. And that's why solar is getting cheap and is continuing to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
You know,
and that's
Bill,
ultimately why it's the cheapest way to generate energy we've ever had in history.
This has been a fantastic conversation because you made me look at things that I already knew in a totally different way.
Oh, cool.
It never occurred to me, but you're right in that solar is technology. And it is, right? It's just like clear as day if you think about it. It's never popped in my head that way. Man, this has been great. I want to keep talking forever, but we're past time already, which I don't care because it's been a great conversation. So let's kind of change subject a little bit because I found this very interesting. So a movie and photography fan, where did that come from?
You know, most of the things in my career, Mark, have come because I stink at sports. And, you know, I started playing with electronics computers when I was in high school, and I started making movies. I fell in love with it. I wanted to be a Disney Imagineer. That was my life's goal when I was younger. I just wanted to be in the entertainment business. So I think that's kind of where those things come out. I love going to theme parks. You know, I asked my wife to marry me at Epcot Center.
How cool is that?
I love that whole magic they create.
Yeah. It's actually one of the things we're actually doing here a little bit. Hopefully I'm wrong, but I think we're already in a recession. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And one of the things during a recession is people still pay for entertainment. So we're shifting a lot of our new shows from being facts and science and educational podcasts to being more entertaining. We have one coming out about the connection between food and energy. How cool is that?
That's so interesting. And then people are so interested in it now because it matters. And there are actually good products to choose from, right? There was no, 10 years ago, if you didn't like the provenance of your beef, you didn't have a lot of choice.
Right.
But now you have lots of options. It's an exciting time for innovators, man. What a great time to be an entrepreneur.
And speaking of great times and innovation, I love this because I'm getting ready to build a new home next year, but home automation. So you geek out over home automation?
I've been using X10 for anyone old enough.
Oh, you're
remember
dating
that?
Yourself now.
Seriously, right? That's like it's right after the dinosaurs. And it was a hobby. And the definition of a hobby is something that you lose money on. Yeah. The definition of a business is something you make money on. And that's where this is another example where a decades of hobbying things that people did because they didn't care about money is now transitioning, about to explode because it has economic value. As we move towards a distributed grid where people are making their own energy in their own homes, the intelligence of that home and how it consumes energy all of a sudden can save families and communities,
yep,
tons of money. And so this hobby thing is now going to turn into a massive business, which is why Google and Apple and all these people are starting to fight like crazy to who's going to own the home automation world and who's going to own the Siri and the Alexa and all those things. Fun time again. This is where entrepreneurs thrive, Mark. This is going to be so fun for innovators and investors.
I agree with you. I just wish we could get a little bit further down the maturity curve and agree upon certain standards so stuff talks to each other.
Well, listen, watch out for Matter and Thread, MATTER and Thread. For any of the nerds listening in, everyone, Google, Apple, they've all agreed this is a universal standard. Products are just starting to come out.
Whoa.
And change the world.
I didn't even know that. That has to be so recent.
Very recent. And these things operate on like coin cell batteries. So you don't have to have Wi-Fi, like your lock's running out of batteries every 3 months because it's on, because it's on Wi-Fi and Wi-Fi takes so much power. This is so cool. 3 or 4 years from now, we're going to wonder how we lived. These systems we have today are going to look antiquated.
Love it. I thought this was great of you. So you support off-grid and microgrid electrification problems in low-income parts of East Africa, as well as Puerto Rico and Caribbean. And it looks like you've even financed some of these, the same sort of stuff in Georgia. That's a great way to give back. And a lot of people I love my country. I'm very patriotic. But a lot of Americans have never left their own country, and they don't know what it's like in the rest of the world. So I just think this is great. So these electrical these projects you're doing in low-income Africa, is this solar cells and batteries, or is it a little bit bigger, like for the community?
Both.
Both.
And in the book, I talk about my travels through Africa and the Caribbean. And in fact, the opening story of the book is a Puerto Rican school and a community around it right after Hurricane Maria, and how a solar-powered microgrid went in there and changed everything. And reports are, after the more recent hurricane, that all those solar microgrid systems are working and completely changed the country's the island's ability to respond from the most recent natural disaster. In Africa, it's an entirely different story because the incomes are so low there. There's people living on $3 a day. And I went there and I talked to people that didn't have electric system, didn't have a solar battery system, and people that did. And the difference was profound. And what's so crazy is all the governments and all the aid programs and all the World Bank, they ultimately didn't make the difference that a bunch of crazy entrepreneurs did that went in there and created these cutting edge systems, got them financed with venture capital. And to me, it's an amazing example of how innovators can solve problems that all the billions from governments and all the policies from governments can't solve. And so the grids of Africa are being built from the outside in. They're being built by innovators and startups and not by large traditional utilities. It's very exciting and gives me great hope. I believe in innovation and entrepreneurs. Certainly they move more quickly, not always wisely, but they do move more quickly than governments. And in cases like electrification for low-income Africa, it's a very good addition to what the governments are doing too.
And what a great thing to do for humanity, right? Because the moment you start providing reliable electricity, you can start educating people. Once you start educating people, it just raises all ships. I love that you're doing that. Let's see. Before we get to our question of the week from Twitter, sincere thank you for the thousands of you that spend your hard-earned money listening to this show. Much love and gratitude. And like I said, at some point, we're going to pick a charity and donate that money to it. Question from Twitter. I still don't agree with you about climate change, Mark, but I do wish more people were open to these types of discussions around polarizing topics. Why do you think it's so hard for people to discuss things they disagree upon? So some of this – and I struggle with this too myself – some of the things that we disagree upon, when I talk to people who have different viewpoints, it's almost like a religion. Like they regardless of what facts or how you want to have the conversation, they feel threatened almost immediately. And as soon as they feel threatened, they shut down and you can't have a conversation. And quite honestly, I haven't figured this out yet. I think part of it is the politicization of everything. I also sometimes think that people have too much of themselves tied to their belief system and it keeps them from opening up. I don't know, Bill, if you want to comment on that or not.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it, Mark, and I think there's a couple of things that have changed. Politicization of everything is core to the problem, and it's fueled entirely by social media. And sadly, social media enables enemies of America to sound like they're Americans and have make this situation even more divisive. So we just live in a somewhat broken world. I think the world has always been broken. This is just a new innovative way to be broken. But I'll tell you what's really the difference between now and 20 years ago is the lack of trust. And I trust that my neighbor has good intentions. They want to raise their child to be successful and happy. They want the world to be a better place when their time is done here. I think every single person wants that, but we've lost the ability to assume that they have more in common with us than differences. And I think I don't want to sound too philosophical because it's a very practical issue. And one of the social media amplifies it. So it allows all of us to live in our own little echo chambers. And so we don't have to hear any opposing voices. We don't have to travel outside the country to see what it's like to live in poverty. There's just a lot of reasons that you can get stuck in your own echo chamber. The other reason is back when you and I were kids, when somebody showed up on the television wearing a white lab coat and a chemistry set, they told us the facts and scientists spoke. They had this sort of universal degree of respect and credibility. And that's gone too, because there's so many scientists now and they will tell you, you can hire a scientist to pretty much say whatever you want. And so we no longer have that crucible we once enjoyed because even science has been thwarted by business and special interests. So I'll tell you what the answer is. It's simple. People just need to get out of their echo chambers and they need to freaking sit down and talk to people that they don't normally talk to.
Yep.
And don't avoid that conversation at Thanksgiving. Have it with respect and love and start the conversation again. I totally believe in human beings. We've just got a little astray in the last couple of years, but we can fix it. I believe strongly we can fix it.
Yeah, it is amazing. So I have a 17-year-old son, and him and his friends, although they're all over social and different social platforms than I use, but it's all over social, they don't believe anything they see on social. So I think his generation, that Generation Z, has learned.
That's a great adapted. Point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Yeah, they're all skeptical. So good for them. 100%. Maybe they will save the future.
Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, and what's sad, Bill, this is the point where I usually would thank the person and mention their Twitter handles. No matter what the question or comment is, if I mentioned their Twitter handle, speaking of bad stuff, they would get haters after them. So now I can't mention the person that left me this comment.
No.
Anyway, person that left me the comment, thank you for your question. Your gourmet OGG and hot sauce is on its way. If you'd like to get a shout out in the show, plus have me personally ship you a bottle of our gourmet hot sauce, follow me on Twitter, Mark_Lacour, and drop a question or comment. All right, Bill, two things we ask all of our guests. First one, what's one thing about energy that you've learned recently?
Policy actually matters. And I was so skeptical of policy. I thought it was dry cement. And this IRA law that's now passed has changed my view on what policy can do. And I think it's good for the oil and gas industry. I think it's phenomenal for the clean energy industry. It moved the needle in a way that most of us have become too jaded to believe possible.
Yeah, there's a ton of opportunity here. That's for darn sure. I just wish they wouldn't have named it IRA. I'm old enough to remember the Irish Republic Army, the terrorists.
I know.
Yeah, I wish they would have named it something else.
But I think Manchin needed to call it inflation reduction. I think economists will probably agree that it helped inflation, but clearly it is an indirect assistance at best. But I think it needed that label to get even the tiny support that it got, that it needed.
Right, to get it through. All right, Bill, here's a chance to plug something important to you. Go.
I'm a huge fan of Acumen, which is the and donate a lot of the money we've made to them. And they are the group that has done this amazing work in Africa. And they help poor people, not just with energy, but along a lot of dimensions. And they basically believe the intersection of capitalism and social impact exists. And if you go and look at the largest and the largest number and the most famous companies in Africa that have provided these solar battery systems we talked about, I think Acumen has been the initial funder of every single one of them. And now they're going into places in West Africa where no businesses have gone. And they're going to try to recreate that same magic and create the same capital-driven help people model. They're calling it hardest to reach. And I just had the CEO of Acumen on my podcast. People should listen in. And if you want to make a difference to energy and economic development, Acumen is one of the best places to donate some money.
Love it. We'll put a link to both Bill's podcast and to Acumen in the show notes, people. So if you're iOS or Android, just scroll upper left and click on the link. All right, Bill, thanks for joining me today. Mild, medium, or hot? I want to send you a bottle of our custom hot sauce to celebrate this conversation.
Well, the answer is with most of us is what will my wife like? And it's the mild. So we'll take that so both of us can enjoy it. Thank you.
All right, you're very welcome. All right. So Bill, hot sauce in the mail, and we will see all of you here again next time.
Stay tuned for more badass conversations on The Balance Point with Mark LaCour, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at OGGN.com.